Welcome to the EmpoweredPatientPodcast.com show. I'm Karen Jagoda. My guest today is George Pappas. He's the CEO of Intraprise Health, intraprisehealth.com. And George, I want to welcome you to the show today. I appreciate you taking a few minutes to be with us to talk about cybersecurity.
Thank you, Karen. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you. Tell us about the kinds of clients that Intraprise Health works with.
We work with doctors' offices, hospitals, health insurance companies, healthcare technology companies, really the entire range of participants in the healthcare industry and healthcare ecosystem.
And would you say that the recent cyber attacks and data breaches have raised the awareness about the need for help from a company like Intraprise Health?
Yes, I would actually say that many in the industry have understood the latent vulnerabilities for quite a while, Karen, but if you think about this Change Healthcare hack earlier in the year, you know, it was so disruptive because you had literally 30% were the numbers that were being read out of sort of the nation's medical practices were actually receiving their insurance claim settlement and reimbursement payments through the Change Network. So when an attack of that magnitude automatically shuts down the way 30% of medical practices get paid, to get everybody's attention and highlight their vulnerabilities.
And what would you say were the biggest lessons that were learned from that attack?
You know, the net situation here, Karen, is that, you know, these large technology companies that serve healthcare and hospital systems and large medical practices, Change is actually basically a clearinghouse, a revenue cycle manager, and a real-time price transparency medication management company, is that they're so complicated and they have so many ways that something can be attacked. And as you mentioned at the beginning, the attackers are getting very clever and sharing a lot of their methods, that you have to do a comprehensive, continuous review of your entire cybersecurity posture. Because if you don't, they're invariably going to be challenges and small things that are small at the time that end up not being small and being the way that an attacker got in. And in the case of Change, you know, it was basically a multi-factor authentication problem accessing a certain system through a certain technology stack that was rather old. But these things exist in companies of this size. I mean, they have, you know, tens of thousands of machines, and you know, they've been accumulating different companies they acquired over time that have different technology systems that don't all work together. So, you know, the vulnerabilities are there and they require, you know, comprehensive risk management and some actually candidly more investment than we've seen to really address fully.
From the conversations I've had with cybersecurity experts, it seems one of the key issues is old technology, software that's not been updated, systems that have a lot of vulnerability because of how many people have access to it. So would you say that's one of the key things that you start with, is just analyzing how old the equipment is and what operating system or what level of software they're currently using?
That's part of it, but I think there's a nuance to your question, Karen, that I want to at least address. You know, large scale enterprise company, meaning software systems by their very nature are very complex. And, you know, whether you're a large hospital system or General Electric or Amazon or others, these systems are very, very complicated. In the case of hospital systems, because they don't really build their software. They buy them from other companies. You can have a software system that a hospital system is running, you know, that could have at its core architecture, it could be 20, 30 years old. Something you hinted at a second ago in your question. When you add to the central systems that they use, like their electronic health record system, but then think about my medical devices that are running old versions of Windows, you can see the sort of complexity and the number of things you have to pay attention to become very large very quickly. And so while we look at that as a an entity that helps these organizations protect themselves, we also look at how it's being operated, how it's being maintained, how user access policies and controls are being managed, how user authentication. Do we really know it's you, Karen, logging into a system, or is it someone impersonating you, for example? So if you think about that, I'll just give you another example because Change is a very large company, but let's bring it down to earth a little bit. You know, across the many regions of the United States, you have kind of mid-sized regional healthcare systems, not the big ones that we all know or the community hospitals, but in the middle, your typical profile of a system like this has maybe four or five hospitals, ambulatory surgery centers, urgent care centers, medical practices, but they might have, Karen, 6,000, 7,000 employees who log into systems every day, okay? So think about that. And they could have 200 or 300 different software systems they use in order to do their job, whether it's cardiology, nephrology, radiology, primary care. And so it's a really vast range of things to address, and the complexity adds to the cost of really handling that. So it's both of those in combination that become the issue, and you have to be able to look at it, recognizing that, okay, you can't fix everything, nor do you really need to fix everything, but how do you prioritize? How do you, in a pragmatic fashion, continually get better and better and better over time? And how do you make sure that when you address something, it doesn't become a problem down the road? Sort of a constant vigilance, if you will, to the policies and procedures and the technologies and the protective kind of rings you put around these technologies. So it's a little bit bigger ball of wax, but I tried to at least break some of it down for you.
That's terrific. And part of that approach is to try to be proactive rather than reactive, wouldn't you say?
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, that's also a very good point. And I'll just give you another sort of, example. So maybe it helps your listeners place this a little better. You know, if you think about someone who has a home, and they're trying to protect their home from all the various threats or things that can happen. Well, you know, their home insurance company requires them to have a smoke detector, carbon monoxide sensor. They get a credit on their policy if they have a burglar alarm system. They might have a Ring doorbell, camera, right? Or any number of things like that. So what you see across the industry is these large hospital systems, small hospital systems, doctor's offices, they're doing those basic things, but here's kind of the issue. That same house that I mentioned, you could have 30 windows in the house. The roof might be a little old. You might have a ground floor door that has a glass could be easily broken if someone tried to break in. So doing a risk management of those things and saying, okay, let's look at the totality, not just the things I've done that I hope will fix the problem, and say, okay, of those things that are open and are problems, what's the probability? What's the impact? What's the cost to mitigate? And that is exactly what you're really describing about proactivity. And in fact, that is where our company was the first high trust healthcare assessor for high trust, which is sort of the most extensive version of being proactive that you described. There are many others, some required by the government, some required by cyber insurance companies, others required by other participants you might deal with in the market. But you're very, accurate to point that out. And it's a challenge because it requires investment of dollars and time. And then it requires a continued effort to go fix those things that you're finding in a continuous improvement mindset with a culture of that at the leadership team of the organization.
And of course, not taking those steps could be a lot more expensive than investing in the security measures. So you must have a lot of interesting conversations with clients about the risk analysis and where their funds should be spent. So is it really a kind of human behavior issue that you're dealing with at some basic level?
I think it's a human behavior issue. And, to your point, we actually, with our clients, we will many times sit down with the board of directors and the security leadership of the company to sort of explain to the board the business impact risks, kind of the relative posture of their system versus others we work with. So I will tell you, yes, there's a communication, leadership, collaboration, sort of team sport dynamic. But the other thing that is also important to understand that maybe your listeners are not as attuned to is the fact that 75% of the hospital systems in the United States are either breaking even or losing money, Karen. People don't understand that. So because of the way we pay for insurance reimbursement in the country, the vast majority of these medium and small systems are having real trouble running with enough financial capacity to be able to actually make these more comprehensive investments to actually be proactive. So kind of getting back to your question. So if I say to a chief financial officer of the hospital, it's going to cost you $750,000 to fix these risks that we found, but they have a cyber insurance policy that has a deductible of $1.2 million. They're going to look at what's the probability of something really bad happening, what's my out-of-pocket cost, and you kind of see where I'm going, right? So it is sort of a risk-adjusted return equation that a CFO, a financial executive of a hospital system, has to make when their relative profitability and their ability to invest in these things is very, very low.
Well, point well made there. And it makes me want to ask you about the role of the employees and the role that the human beings play in these cyber attacks. The person clicking on the email they shouldn't, the person giving out a password they shouldn't. Say a little bit more what even a small hospital can do in the way of educating employees, contractors who come onto the property, anybody who touches equipment or touches a medical device, in terms of keeping them out of helping a cybersecurity or helping a cyber a criminal.
Yeah, it's an excellent point because that is still one of the top ways that these attacks happen. And because think about the example I just gave you, you have 7,000 employees logging into a system every day. So they only have to be wrong once and something happens. So what are the things you can do? There are several of them. You know, the first thing is you can have a stronger form of password protection, and we call it identity management and authentication. So if we know that Karen Jagoda is logging into a system, we know it's really you. There are several tools that these system companies use today to kind of verify your identity and authenticate that at the time you log in. But those aren't still as widely used as they really could be. But that's one example. Another example is that you can kind of partition your computer network so that people in finance, for example, don't have access to the patient data and your electronic health record. Or people who are working in, you know, a certain area of logistics don't need to get access to that same information. And there's a lot of energy being spent in this area. The rubric, the term is called zero trust, and it has a lot of different permutations. But really what we're saying is even when you're logged into the system, we're going to isolate the damage you could do if you were really, a cyber criminal from somewhere else was already in our system. How can you protect someone inside the home, if you will? The third thing, and we actually work with clients in this all the time, is sort of running a test so that every employee gets kind of conditioned to being attuned to these kinds of issues. You know, the common term we use is phishing tests, and essentially it's sort of like a simulated cyber attack where we send all different kinds of clever messages trying to get people to click on them when they shouldn't. And then over time, you see patterns. Some people are more susceptible to that than others. Some are not. But the point is the employees and the system and the contractors are used to it. Just like, when we were in school, we had like a fire drill, how to leave the school if something bad happened. You have to get people kind of give them some muscle memory. It's a thing they just have to be attentive to every day by doing these kinds of drills.
Well, it just sounds to me like it's the modern workplace basic hygiene that you're talking about. So before I let you go today, tell us a little bit about your training as a cybersecurity expert and your interest in fighting cyber criminals.
Well, my training really comes from, 35 years of enterprise software and understanding. You talked about this at the beginning. If you look from the inside out of an enterprise software system, you see Swiss cheese, lots of holes, right? So that's kind of knowing the technical qualities of those holes and how to fix them has been part of my life's work in the software industry. Between that and, you know, spending now a decade in healthcare IT and to be, you know, deeply involved in what are the, how do hospital systems communicate and share data with each other? How do they address core issues of sensitive access to electronic prescribing, controlled substance, patient record information? So that really, that training, that experience has really informed, you know, my view and our really vision as a company and how we try to help our clients solve for these problems.
And would you say this problem is becoming even more prevalent with the explosion of data and devices, both in the office and in the operating room?
Yes, absolutely. Because the combinatorial complexity of it just went up by a very large factor. Now, we spend a lot of time talking about, you know, bad things. We should maybe spend a minute or two on some good things. You know, the federal government kind of moves slowly, but when it wakes up, it wakes up. And, you know, there are several bills that are from the House of Representatives and the Senate, HHS, working with CISA. There are a number of initiatives now that are really gaining a lot of speed. And between regulatory requirements with some funding for the hospitals that don't have the financial capacity, combined with the market discipline of cyber insurance carriers now, after a couple of years, they're learning how to assess risk and how to really examine a hospital before they able to provide them insurance. You know, I think you were seeing the beginnings of, you know, the healthcare system recognizing what it takes to be more proactive and, you know, what do best practices for that look like and how can we validate that they're actually being followed? Because, you know, that's one of the most important things we can do among several others to try and start to navigate our way out of this in a more constructive fashion.
And might AI play a role in being a watchdog and helping identify some of these vulnerabilities?
Absolutely. Though it's also making the criminals harder to catch. But yes, AI can be used. We use it for some of the products in our company to identify gaps in risk management. And there's going to be many, many ways AI can make a lot of the platforms that our clients use now even more intelligent in identifying anomalies before they become deeper problems. So it's a very important development for the field.
Thanks to my guest today, George Pappas, CEO of Enterprise Health, enterprisehealth.com. I'm Karen Jagoda, and you've been listening to the EmpoweredPatientPodcast.com show. Like us on Facebook at Empowered Patient Radio. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.